thank you very much to the organizers for inviting me to participate in this conference. Now, as I sit here, it's just been 13 years since we've got our independence. We went straight from slavery to colonialism to post-colonialism in the form of apartheid, and 13 years ago we had our first democratic elections. Bear in mind also that when we had our Truth and Reconciliation Commission, our act was passed in 1995. So when I discuss the TRC process in South Africa, a lot of what are now accepted as international norms regarding transitional justice were still in the sense not yet been developed, within the process of being developed. However, having said that, the whole issue of amnesty has come back to the fore in South Africa. I suppose this is not unusual, because according to research done by Louis Malinder, there have been 420 amnesty processes since the Second World War, a large number of them occurring in the last 25 years. Now, we are characterized as being a successful amnesty process. I'd like to suggest that, like the French Revolution, I think the jury is still out on the issue. But having said that, the form that Truth and Reconciliation Commission takes and the form that the amnesty process takes is usually determined by the balance of forces on the ground. If the one side is overwhelmingly successful, has conquered the other side has collapsed, a la West Germany, East Germany, a la the Second World War, you're going to have either treason trials or Nuremberg commissions, etc. If there's a balance of forces where there's a bit of a stalemate, you're going to have an amnesty process, because the one side still is a threat to the other side. And this is what usually determines the form of what the TRC process takes. So what is the situation in South Africa in 1994, leading up to our first election? Nelson Mandela had been released for about 3 years. The then apartheid government was dragging out negotiations. They were going nowhere. The liberation movement and the people on the ground were committed to rendering the country ungovernable. The apartheid government had increased its death squads. A further 300 people had been trained in then Namibia, and they'd unleashed them. We're having massacres which were taking place at train stations, massacres taking place at taxi ranks, and massacres taking place without anyone being charged or arrested. Things were reaching a climax when the leader of the Communist Party, which is also part of the African National Congress in our peculiar political arrangements, was assassinated by far-right-wing elements. So we had a situation where things were on a knife edge. Parties had agreed on most items through negotiations. The one item that was stuck on was the issue of amnesty. On the one hand, you had the ANC, which wanted a Nuremberg situation. People who committed gross violations of human rights should be tried. On the other hand, you had the apartheid regime, which wanted a blanket amnesty. In fact, they attempted to have a blanket amnesty for all security forces, but that was rejected out of hand. So a compromise was reached. And you'll find that in our interim constitution in 1993, tucked right at the end of the constitution, we called it an epilogue, because we didn't know what to call it. They had this long section which they, in very poetic language, said the following. The Constitution provides a historic bridge between the past of a deeply divided society characterized by strife, conflict, untold suffering, and injustice, and a future founded on the recognition of human rights, democracy, and peaceful coexistence, and development opportunities for all South Africans, irrespective of color, race, class, belief, or sex. The pursuit of national unity, the well-being of all South African citizens, and peace require reconciliation between the people of South Africa and the reconstruction of society. The adoption of this constitution lays down the secure foundation for the people of South Africa to transcend the divisions and strife of the past, which generated gross violations of human rights, the transgressions of humanitarian principles in violent conflicts, and a legacy of hatred, fear, guilt, and revenge. These can be addressed on the basis that there is a need for understanding, but not for revenge, a need for reparation, but not for retaliation, a need for ubuntu, but not for victimization. In order to advance such reconciliation and reconstruction, amnesty shall be granted in respect of acts, omissions, and offenses associated with political objectives and committed in the course of the conflicts of the past. So there was an agreement that there would be amnesty. It took another year after our first democratic elections and massive debates in Parliament for the actual act to be passed in terms of what the format and the process would be for amnesty applications. What's very important about this is that we have agreement in principle between the political parties that there would be amnesty. You have the statement stuck in the Constitution committing ourselves to amnesty. We then have an election based on that interim constitution, and now we have a legitimate parliament, people who had been democratically elected, and it's this democratically elected parliament which then debates what the contents of the actual act should be regarding the truth and reconciliation process. So the whole process was therefore legitimated and it's seen as part of the overall democratic package that we had. It was this interim body which then finalized the constitution. They constituted themselves as a constituent assembly, and eventually we had a final constitution. Also, this interim body consisted of a government of national unity. Any political party which got more than 10% was given a seat in the cabinet. So again, there was legitimacy across the political spectrum. Civil society played a very active role throughout this whole process. Usually find in transitional periods, especially parties coming from the opposition, they tend to listen a bit more to civil society. Once they've been in power for a bit, they tend to ignore civil society. Fortunately, early days, civil society was able to influence the process. A very, very crucial aspect was that the two political parties, two contenders, the ANC and the old National Party, the Apartheid Party, both wanted all processes of the commission to be in private, no public hearings. It was pressure from civil society which insisted that all hearings should be in public, whether for amnesty or whether on gross violations of human rights. They had to be in public, and civil society actually won out, so that all the processes were in public. Now, we had been influenced by the Latin American commissions, but we differed from them in a number of respects. One of them was the issue of public hearings. The second issue was that we had the power in our truth commission to name perpetrators. The third aspect was that we had the power of search and seizure, and we had the power of subpoenaing people to appear before the truth commission. So we had the National Unity and Reconciliation Act passed in 1995, and three committees were established. The Committee on Human Rights Violations. Their function was to conduct inquiries into gross violations of human rights and present a complete as possible a picture of detailing human rights violations in South Africa during this period. The Committee on Reparations and Rehabilitation, whose function was to gather information and make recommendations regarding reparation for victims. And the Amnesty Committee, which had the jurisdiction to grant complete amnesty to applicants who met certain conditions. Let us quickly focus on the Amnesty Committee. The Amnesty Committee consisted of lay people as well as judges from the Supreme Court. They had been seconded to the Amnesty Committee. They heard applications for amnesty for any gross violations of human rights. Our Act defined gross violations of human rights as being killings, abduction, torture, severe ill treatment. If there was any amnesty claimed for gross violation of human rights, there had to be a public hearing. It had to be chaired by a judge. Whilst the commission as a whole could review any of the committees, it could not review decisions of the Amnesty Committee. The Amnesty Committee was independent of the commission in terms of its decisions. You would get amnesty if, one, it had to be by individual application, so a political party couldn't submit a whole stack of names. Two, you had to make full disclosure. Three, the act for which you're applying for amnesty had to be proportional to what the objective was. So, for example, if you say, I committed this sexual assault, I committed a rape for whatever reason, that could never be proportional to the objective you wanted, and therefore you could never get amnesty for rape. Four, it had to be part of the political processes taking part, political groupings. Let me give you an example. We had a group which no one had ever heard of before, calling themselves the National Socialist Partisans. Three white men who went around and killed a white pensioner, and then killed her domestic worker and killed her gardener. And they claimed they were trying to get guns for the white right-wing armed revolution. Because this was not part of the overall political contestation taking place, they were not a recognized political grouping, they didn't qualify for amnesty. So those were the requirements that were there for amnesty. Now, of course, we were overwhelmed in terms of applications. We had 7,000 applications for amnesty. Ultimately, only 1,200 people were successful in the applications for amnesty. What you found was the people who applied for amnesty were either those who were already in jail, and of course, even every person took a chance, were sitting in jail, say whatever they did was for political reasons. Secondly, those people who were being investigated and they were about to be charged, they were about to appear in court, so they wanted to go apply for amnesty. Thirdly, there were a handful of people who actually had a crisis of conscience who wanted to actually unburden themselves, often black members of the security forces. As a general rule, the political leadership, the people who gave the orders, didn't apply for amnesty. The political parties by themselves appeared before the Gross Violations of Human Rights Committee and had to answer questions. And I say this because it's not part of the amnesty process, but it's extremely important in order to build our democracy, where we even had now ruling party, the ANC, appearing before us, and we could ask them questions such as on necklacing, this horrible thing of burning people to death, on putting landmines, about international humanitarian law about harming civilians. We could ask them about how they treated their own people in their camps, where they allegedly executed some people who were supposedly spying for the apartheid regime. Similarly, we tried the same thing with the National Party. But by and large, the leadership has remained outside the process. Now, in terms of our act, if you were refused amnesty, or if you did not apply for amnesty, then you should be charged in a criminal court like any other criminal. And we're coming back to that now. We received a number of challenges. Firstly, it's important also to note that our definitions were politically neutral. Gross violations of human rights didn't depend whether you were fighting for the apartheid regime or fighting against the apartheid regime. Killing and abduction torture was that. Similarly, a victim wasn't politically defined. You could be a policeman who was shot, who could be a victim, and similarly you could be a person who's been disappeared and his families would be victims. So that was politically neutral. We were challenged in the Constitutional Court by victims whose family had been killed by security forces. The one was a human rights lawyer. He'd been abducted on his way to work, viciously stabbed, left for dead. The other one was a doctor, supposedly sympathetic to liberation movements. He was shot in front of his wife on his doorstep. The activist lawyer, his wife was also a lawyer. She was also murdered in her home. Then you had Steve Biko. As you know, he was assaulted until he was left brain damaged and then driven 1,000 kilometers at the back of a Land Rover, semi-naked, and he eventually died of the injuries he suffered. And our Minister of Justice infamously said he had the democratic right to starve himself to death. Now, these were the families, and these were genuine victims who challenged us, as they were justified in doing, saying that you have no right to give amnesty to people. In terms of our constitution, all crimes should be justiciable. The court, and remember, at the time of our democracy, we had one black judge, and the judge only became a judge because change was imminent. So it's all white judges. We created the Constitutional Court in order to ensure that there would be a proper hearing of constitutional cases, and that is also a post-democratic institution. The Chief Justice, without saying so, was clearly aware that the issue of amnesty was as much part of the whole settlement as the government of national unity, and as the whole two-phase system regarding the constitution. So without saying so, he could not reject the whole issue of amnesty, because it would undermine the whole negotiated process. He confirmed and he stated very eloquently, generations of children had been born into poverty. The state hasn't got sufficient resources to be deployed imaginatively to free the potential of the people. Choices would have to be made about providing funds for food and education and roofs for the homeless, etc. And these were all very real concerns. I mean, just let me just quickly say, apartheid was not a picnic. We had 8 million people homeless. When I say homeless, I mean not even informal shelter. We had 10% of the amount spent on white children being spent on black children. We've had 87% of the land by law taken away from black people and given to white people. 1913-1936 Land Acts. By the way, if you think Zimbabwe has got a problem, 13 years after independence, only 4% of that land has been given back to black people. We've had a government which basically destroyed a few generations of its people. So it's a pretty vicious, racist government. Sum total of it all was that it felt that they had part of a historical process, part of a negotiated settlement, amnesties were valid. We also had challenges to the process by alleged perpetrators. We had a challenge whereby alleged perpetrators went to court and stated that if an allegation is made in public about me, I should be given prior warning about this allegation. Res illius acta is a Latin phrase we use. Let the other side be heard. In a judgment given by our highest administrative court, a judgment which some of us think was politically charged and intellectually challenged, they felt that before any allegation is made about any person, that person had to be given prior warning. Now you can imagine, we're trying to look at events which took place from 1960 to 1994. You had to now try and track people down. You had to put adverts in the newspaper. You had to actually find out who was going to make allegations against whom. I'll give you an example of what the implication of this was. Okay. We have a young student called Simpiwe Mtimkulu. He is detained by the police. While in detention, they poison him with a heavy metal poison called thallium. This is the same poison which this Russian gentleman who was poisoned in London, they suspected it was thallium. It wasn't thallium eventually. After eventually his blood samples are sent to Europe, we discover what the poison was, and he's being treated as an outpatient. While he's an outpatient, still in a wheelchair, he is kidnapped by the police, him and his friend, murdered, burnt, bodies disposed of in a river, and the car is left next to the border. The police, on a regular basis, at early hours of the morning, then go to the mother's house, wake the whole family up, terrorize the family, accuse him of having gone overseas for guerrilla training, whilst they knew they had, in fact, murdered him. She wanted to say in our hearing that she had heard another security branch policeman say, this is what happened, he heard that so-and-so was responsible. This was challenged. So we had to, thereafter, give notification to all people who were accused of any gross violation before the names were mentioned. Also, at all stages, we were subject to the Constitution, and the Constitution had a very strong Bill of Rights. So we've had our chairperson, Archbishop Tutu, been cross-examined for 2-3 days in court when we subpoenaed the previous president, P.W. Botha, to appear in court. So everything was subject to the Constitution. I'm just going to summarize quickly. What has happened is that post-1995, there have been very few prosecutions of people who didn't apply for amnesty or who refused amnesty. There's been some minor policemen, 2 or 3 of them, who've been charged. Civil society, especially victims groups, have now challenged this and have gone to court on this issue. What the government has done has produced what they call prosecutorial guidelines. They've incorporated those principles involved in the amnesty process, which was going to be a public process. And remember, it was a public process where if anyone is actually charged, applies for amnesty, we would trace any victims involved. We would assist them in appearing before the amnesty committee. And if they couldn't afford lawyers, we would fund lawyers for them so that they could oppose amnesty applications if they so wished. Now it's all going to be behind closed doors, where this decision is going to be made by the Director of Public Prosecutions, and a de facto amnesty is going to be given to people who are not who are going to be charged. It's happened already with our previous Minister of Justice. He rediscovered God, and got very religious. And he's been going around washing the feet of his alleged victims. One of the people whose feet he washed was the director of the Office of the President of South Africa. He was there's an attempt to kill him by poisoning him. He was traveling overseas on a church mission. They poisoned his clothes with phosphates. And every time he put on his clothes, he was poisoned. Anyway, what happened is that he then, by agreement, appeared before court. He was given a suspended sentence after pleading guilty. The president has, and my very last statement, the president last month has said that there are 1,261 people who have applied for pardons, and he is in fact putting together a reference group consisting of all political parties in parliament to talk about guidelines to give pardons to people who are already serving sentences. So there is a very serious concern that impunity is being introduced through the back door, and civil society is in fact trying to organize around this to try and block this impunity. But the issue has not gone away, and as we used to say in the struggle days, our luta continua. Thank you.